Chapter 18. Cassilda's Song. I go back to my shiny office with a brown bag lunch, and I sit at my desk, trying to eat, despite my suddenly leaden stomach. I manage to choke down half a low-calorie Mexican wrap before a wave of nausea grips me, and I quick march to the bathroom, where I throw up as quietly as I can. Afterwards, I lean on the wash basin until the dry heaves are definitely under control. Then I brush out my hair and carefully check my face for makeup damage. It's not like I haven't been staked out as a tethered goat before now. In fact, it's how I ended up auditioning for the White Violin in the first place. After the incident in Amsterdam with Bob in the museum archive and the tentacles, I went looking for some way of protecting myself. Because never again sounds pretty good if you've ever been grabbed by a halfway sentient monster and used as a fishing lure. The phrase, "I'd rather die than do that again," springs to mind, and I'm not exaggerating. If it happens again, going quietly into that dark night is my plan B. Plan A is to fight like a rabid bobcat. Anyway, the point is that Dr. Armstrong is thoroughly aware of my service record. If anyone should be expected to know better than to put me in such a position, it'd be him. Or if not him, Bob. But Bob is not my line manager, for which, praise the Lord. And that's why I'm throwing up in the bathroom and trying not to let any sound escape. I don't want to frighten everyone. I trust the SA would not do this to me unless, in his professional opinion, there was absolutely no alternative. Freudstein has run rings around the police and backed the SA into a corner so tight that the only way out entails a risk of civilian collateral damage. No, let's not be euphemistic here. Scores of civilian deaths. And a senior agent's sanity. So, he's hung it on me like a fucking dead albatross. And there's nobody to vent on, because he's my regular workplace confessor, and Bob is unavailable. Worse, Bob is unreliable. I know exactly what Bob would say if I told him about this. He'd tell me to spit in Dr. Armstrong's eye, and I love him for it. But I can't turn this assignment down because you'll agree with me that it was necessary when you have the full facts. Nor can I reasonably vent on anyone else. Jim, for example. Right. So be it resolved. At the end of the month, Lecter is going to check in with internal assets for secure storage. And if I don't agree that the ends justify the means in the case of this assignment, Dr. Armstrong will have my resignation. I go back to my desk, pale and sick with fear, and sit like a sack of potatoes for the next hour while I try to mentally digest. At which point, it gets to be too much. So I hang out a do not disturb sign, lock my office door, and give myself a timed crying jag. Another makeup refresh, and I feel well enough to unlock the door and resume the robotic semblance of business as usual. But I still feel as if I've been mugged, or discovered Bob was cheating on me or something like that. Later that afternoon, I managed to sit through a meeting without losing it, and although Mary gives me a few strange glances, I don't think anyone else really notices. When it's time to go home, I collect Lecter from my office safe, and I manage to navigate my way via bus and tube without jumping its shadows more than 3 or 4 times. Anyone who notices it probably puts it down to one triple shot latte too many, or to my non-existent nose candy habit. I shovel the violin case into the safe, lock the front door, then inspect the wards on all the walls and windows twice over, before I can relax enough to take my jacket and shoes off and make a pot of tea. The sleeping pills get a workout that night, despite Spooky's best attempts to wake me up so I can play with her at 4 in the morning. And I'm still a little groggy when the alarm wakes me at 6:30. But at least I don't have any more horrible dreams about performing naked in front of the Police Federation at the Albert Hall, or dancing with Lecter in doomed Kirkosa. And with sleep comes a sense of normality resuming. Or at least the routinization of fear. The fearful takes another step towards becoming the new normal when I return to the office that morning, violin slung over my shoulder. I deliberately vary my routine. Leave at a different time, walk to a different bus stop, catch the tube between two different stations, and cover the last mile by taxi, and damn the expense. I stole Lecter in my office safe, neither opening the case nor trying to talk to him in my own head. Let sleeping curses lie. And I get on with my life, pointedly paying no attention to the Damoclesian sword the essay so helpfully drew to my attention. The essay is not so easily ignored. We still have some paper mail to process, and a small padded envelope arrives via my entry. When I open it, a plain-looking metal band falls out. Silver, I think. Like a very plain wedding ring. I recognise his fussily old-fashioned handwriting on the note that has spindled through it like a treacherous promise. Dominique, this is the sympathetic link ring I mentioned yesterday. I requisitioned it from its previous holder. Ms. Murphy already wears the counterpart. It will enable you to contact her in event of the emergency I mentioned. I have requested the preparation of a set of four linked rings for your entire team, but they will take at least 10 days to arrive. I scowl at the ring, then on impulse raise it to my nose and sniff it. My fingertips prickle slightly. I get a sense of Mary's presence from it, but why is there someone else? Someone familiar. Damn Dr. Armstrong, damn him to hell. I slide the ring onto my right ring finger, where it fits snugly, despite having been sized for a male hand when I shook it out of the bag. Barely 30 seconds pass before my desk phone rings. I pick it up. Dr. O'Brien. It's Mary. She's using my surname, which is unusual these days. The weeks of after-work drinks have, if nothing else, put us on a first-name basis. Yes, Mary. My finger twitches. Is it the ring with a sympathetic link? I hear her sharp intake of breath. Yes. Where did you get it? I chew my lip for a moment. The SA gave it to me. He's concerned about our ability to coordinate in an emergency. If one of us was on the tube, for example, unreachable by phone. He's getting us a complete set for the entire team, but it'll be a couple of weeks. He said in the meantime, I should get used to this one. I see. She sounds slightly taken aback. Why me? Why not? I reply with forced levity. We're where the buck stops. I suppose so. But she sounds doubtful. Suspicious, even. As she puts the phone down. Yet another item to add to the list of questions I'd really like to put to Mary, but can't justify asking, for fear of wrecking our working relationship. Around 10 o'clock, Ramona whirs gleefully into my office. They've arrived, she cries. What have arrived? Our uniforms. Come on, come on. Don't you want to see how you look in skin-tight lycra? I really don't. I really, really don't. But I go on anyway because staff morale trumps personal body image issues. When you're the chief exec, you can't afford to balk at superficially innocuous activities that you've prescribed to your staff. So I follow Ramona out to her office, where Mary is unpacking a big brown cardboard box full of plastic-wrapped stuff. What? She says. Am I expected to wear? No, this is yours. Ramona nudges her wheelchair towards another shipping carton. We've got another 4 for the B team. This is for sizing, if they don't fit properly. I'll send them back for adjustments before we put through the full order. You can change in the bathroom stalls. I bridle at that. Excuse me, but I have an office of my own. I pick up the box Ramona's pointing at and head for the door. Best get the indignity over in private. The box is surprisingly heavy. You and Mary can meet me in my outer office in half an hour, I tell her. In uniform. I will say this for Ramona. Her prototype uniform for the Transhuman Police Coordination Force resembles a police assault uniform much more than the G-cut bustier with miniskirt that I'd been dreading. It is not skin tight, apart from the fireproof ripstop leggings that go under the cargo pants and gear belt. It protects vital assets, with anti-stab ceramic inserts rather than letting them all hang out on display. The gloves are nice and flexible, and the helmet is full of exceptionally expensive-looking mil-spec Google Glass work-alike electronics. Although you can take them out and wear them strapped to your face, Borg-style. The boots are sourced from one of the suppliers where the cool Special Forces kids go to spend their pocket money when they're unhappy with their army-issue combat boots. I pull it on, without undue difficulty, fasten everything up, and discover to my surprise that it actually makes me feel like I'm ready to kick down doors and arrest supervillains. It's got GPS and airwave radio and built-in cellular digital and even supports a bolt-on night vision monocular. There's just one problem with it. As I tell my executive team, aside from Jim, who is at ACPO headquarters for some kind of meeting today, the home sex focus group will take one look at this and tell you to sex it up. Ramona's version of the uniform is tailored to her anatomy. Hers is skin tight in places, but it's the skin tight fit of thick layered neoprene rather than nylon or lycra, because it doubles as a wetsuit for a mermaid. Mary raises an eyebrow at me. Why do you think that'll be a priority? She asks. You know perfectly well why. I only recognise her ironically raised eyebrow once I've opened my mouth. So I bull on just in case I'm misinterpreting her. For the same reason they want a balanced team rather than a competent one. It doesn't fit the cultural agenda they're trying to impose. We look like police officers trialling some kind of experimental next-generation tactical uniform. Because we are, Ramona interrupts. Thank you. But the point is, we're supposed to look like we stepped out of a superhero movie. We don't even have capes, which is good. But it's not what they ordered, so it's a lever to use against us. I cross my arms defensively. I can pull the health and safety defense, but I'm not sure I can make it stick. So don't tell them just yet, Mary suggests. I mean, let's at least see if they're workable on operational deployment. If it works in the field, they'll have a much harder job spiking it. And, she shrugs, sleekly statuesque, and for a moment I almost see her as some kind of far future space marine. I, for one, really don't want to be told my uniform needs to show more bare skin for the teen gamer demographic. Okay, I think for a moment. How about you try this on the B-team and get their feedback, Ramona? I'm going to wear mine around the office today and see if there are any obvious adjustments needed for chafing or wear. If we get called an active deployment, we'll trial it. Otherwise, though, we keep it under wraps, just in case. Just in case, Mary echoes, nodding her approval. I feel a flash of gratitude, then annoyance. I don't need her approval. It's still pleasant, though. How about I go and roust out Bee and Torch? I'll send them up to your office, Ramona. Then we can go and have a fashion parade and scare all the analysts. Jim is back in the force on Wednesday. After we tested the uniforms around the office all Tuesday, Ramona packaged them up and sent them for dry cleaning, and in some cases alteration or replacement. So I invite Jim into my office to show him the video Nick recorded of our impromptu fashion show. His reaction isn't what I expected. HM Inspector of Constabulary will have to approve these, he says bluntly. And I can tell you up front that the uniform committee will probably reject them or ask for big changes. Wait, what? I stop dead. But we need item. Opaque face masks are right out, even for riot gear. Forbidden by policy, It makes it hard to identify officers from CCTV footage. Item: I see no badge numbers on display. Ditto on identification. Ramona didn't ask for the standards for uniforms, did she? Nowhere to show rank insignia. Those equipment belts are all wrong, and there's a standing directive to avoid looking like Imperial stormtroopers. Jim. I try not to sigh. I'm supposed to be running a superhero team. They're supposed to look like they're capable of lifting you by the throat and snarling, "You have failed me for the last time." I minimize the window and stare at him. What's eating you? Sorry. Yesterday left a bad taste in my mouth. He shakes his head, as if trying to dislodge an annoying fly that's buzzing around. Our dog and pony show the other week made bigger waves than I realized, apparently. Several chiefs went home and started asking about civil contingency planning, and now they've got their knickers in a twist because we're making them look as if they're unprepared. So, the first order of their day, after helping themselves to all the reports I've written on the subject for the past 9 months, was to spread a little gloom around, which means making all this, his sweeping hand gesture takes in the entire building, redundant. So they've set up a working group on responding to extra-legal paranormal activity, staffed entirely from within existing forces, rather than borrowing from the Ministry of Defence. I bite my tongue, furious with myself for the sudden stab of relief at knowing I'm going to be off the hook if this goes through. What's that supposed to mean? It means there's going to be a ministerial-level pissing match. And I, for one, have technically been caught offside. Which may actually work out in your favour, Mo. But only if you want to really make this fly as a police support organisation rather than a stalking horse for your own department. Well, I fall silent, unable to think of anything else to say that won't come across as bitter and cynical. After the SA's bombshell on Monday, this is exactly what I least needed. I've got a meeting in half an hour to discuss a deployment roster for the junior supervillain busters once they've finished their training period. But I'd rather just cancel and go home and hide under the bed crying. Not that that's possible. I look at Jim. Is there any good news? Oh, well, I was hoping you'd ask. Suddenly he looks smug, as if he's been plotting something. Come on, spill it. I acquired a pair of concert tickets. No, he smiles. For this Saturday evening, I know it's short notice, but would you like to accompany me to the last night of the proms? My jaw drops. What? How? I asked around, and these two dress circle seat tickets sort of fell into my pocket. He looks innocent. The kind of innocent you get when you call her a pickpocket. Fell into your pocket, my ass. Pardon my French. Do I want to go to the highlight of the prom season with Jim? Do bears defecate in Sylvanian ecosystems? As my husband once put it. Yes or no? He presses. I'm trying to decide between yes and hell yes. You're not making it easy. I take a deep breath. Of course I'll go. Assuming, you didn't have to bribe or murder anyone to get the tickets, did you? There were no witnesses and you buried the bodies properly. The BBC proms are not some kind of high school dance, but a century-old season of orchestral classical music concerts held every late summer around the UK, but mostly in the Royal Albert Hall in London. These days, they're the biggest classical music festival in the world, with over 100 concerts and spin-off events in a variety of other cities. I've been to plenty of concerts at the Albert Hall before, and even to proms concerts, but haven't had time to do so this year due to the pressure of work. And I've never got into the last night, the climax of the season. There are queues for tickets at the best of times, and no guarantees. And you can't buy tickets for the last night at all, unless you can present ticket stubs from 5 earlier concerts. See pressure of work above. People with tickets, standing tickets at that, often queue overnight just to make sure they can get in. Dress code? Anything goes, but fancy dress is recommended. There's a lot of patriotic flag waving, especially at the close when they play Rule Britannia. Music. Aside from the regular playlist, there are pieces courtesy of everyone from the Pet Shop Boys to Prokofiev by way of Benjamin Britten and Beethoven. Oh, and the last night of the proms gets broadcast live on national TV and radio, with big screen video repeaters at satellite concerts in other cities. As I said, it's the biggest classical music cultural event of the year in London, and has been so ever since the 1890s. In terms of excitement, it's the musical equivalent of a major Apple product release. For Jim to suddenly produce a pair of reserved seats is only marginally more plausible than for him to reach into his tunic breast pocket and pull out three live rabbits and a partridge in a pear tree. So when he reaches into the aforementioned pocket and produces two familiar-looking concert tickets, I can't help myself. I gape at him.
"I had to pull some strings,"
he says slightly smugly. "But I didn't have to kill anybody or even blackmail anyone, honest. Actually, what happens is that a bunch of tickets get allocated every year to various London organisations. Fire service, ambulance, you get the picture. Some of the private box holders donate them, or sell them, and donate the proceeds to charity. Many of the boxes at the Royal Albert Hall are privately owned. I gather the leasehold on a box cost anything up to £500,000. The Met regularly gets about a dozen, most of which go in the charity raffle. I owe some favours if we take these, so if you don't want them, I need to know right now so I can give them back and apologise." "You didn't raid a raffle pot." I stare at him, eyes narrowing. "Because if you..." "No." He sounds shocked. "I'd never do something like that. But between you and me, the commissioners... rather more fond of the Sex Pistols and the Clash than he is of Elgar. He's a police and thieves man." Suddenly his eyes widen. "Please, for the love of all that's holy, don't ever mention that in front of any journalists. It's really not the image he wants to project. If word got out..." I manage to shut my mouth. Gaping is unseemly, and anyway, if I gape any wider, I'll dislocate my jaw. London's top cop has a secret fondness for punk rock? The timing fits. Punk is 40-something these days, and the boss would have been a teenager bopping to 45s and spiking his hair with soap back in the day. His secret is safe with me. I manage, making a fist and holding it to my heart. It will accompany me to the grave. Then I succumb to a quiet fit of the giggles. "So you wouldn't mind accompanying me to the last night of the proms, using a ticket rejected by a superannuated old punk?" I hesitate momentarily. The SA is setting me up as bait. But whoever he's stalking wouldn't dare do anything at such a public event, would they? Besides, I'll have Jim at my side. And as bodyguards go, officer friendly is pretty hardcore. It's a date. The rest of the week passes. I do meetings, back to the Home Office on Thursday for a relatively gentle anal probing by the aliens from Professional Standards, followed by a brisk session with a pair of auditors who, while far more innocuous than our own, are still capable of putting me in a very uncomfortable spot while reviewing my budget projections. I carry on reading my homework, remember to go to the gym, and order up a supermarket food delivery. I keep procrastinating and finding reasons not to pull Jim aside for that talk. The one about K syndrome and wards and brain scans and not overdoing the superpowers. On the other hand, we're not punching villains right now, so it's less urgent than it might otherwise be. And as the matter's now on the radar, it occurs to me that Jim isn't the only one at risk. So I add to my overflowing to-do list. Institute regular K syndrome medical screening for all personnel. I even find time to go out for drinks with the girls on Thursday evening, although I keep my date with Jim to myself for the time being. Friday. a big meeting with the analysts and the B-team. We're working up that list of 3 Sigma and better supernormals, and my people have begun to launder them past the PNC database to see if any of them may be persons of interest from a criminal point of view. I'm not so much concerned about teenage drinking exploits as a long record of armed robbery followed by the development of superpowers. If we can find the next Catwoman wannabe before she starts knocking over banks, that'd be a generally all-around good idea. But we're still no closer than before to identifying possible candidates for Professor Freudstein, which leaves me walking around with the skin of the small of my back crawling as if there's a crosshairs painted there. I can't shake the essay's worrying implication that Freudstein is a front for an organisation, that they are inside our institutional decision loop, and that the raid on the British Library rare music manuscript store and Dr. Armstrong's unhealthy concern for me and my instrument are connected. I am developing a nervous habit of checking whichever warded safe Lecter is stashed in, whether at home or at work, every couple of hours, even when I haven't been out of the room. I can't see this ending well for anyone. Even though the sleeping pills are working, and I'm free from intrusive dreams for the time being. Other stuff happens, of course. The cleaned, altered uniforms are delivered, complete with kit bags, so we can take them home in case of an out-of-hours call-out. Whoopee. Mary and I test our rings, until I get the hang of inconspicuously getting her attention. They're basically magical pagers, able to run without a power source and work in places where there's no cellular coverage. Finally, there's an afternoon training review with the Junior Mythobusters, as Sam has christened the B-team. B, Torch, Lollipop Bill, and Captain Marvelous. Then a bunch of routine budget approval forms to fill out, and that's my working week done. I collect the violin from my office safe and the uniform kit bag from under my desk, then lock my office door. It's nearly 8 o'clock. The sky is darkening towards twilight as I nod at Marek, our shaven-headed evening shift door guard, and head for home. Lecter is a presence at my back, his case slung over the small of my back like a reliquary holding the unclean remains of a perverted saint. He feels oddly heavy and quiescent, as if waiting for something. The sky overhead is the sickly orange red of streetlights reflecting off clouds, and my forehead feels tight, a premonition of a thunderstorm hanging fire. My unease as I walk towards the nearest bus stop is not the normal one I've become accustomed to since the SA sprang his unwelcome surprise on Monday. And in any case, if anyone or anything thinks they can take me on the streets of London, they're making a very big mistake. But something is nagging at the edges of my attention, like a spectre scratching at the decaying lich gate of a graveyard. Oh, that. Yes, I ask coldly.
Can we talk?
I swear, if a raw head and bloody bones could whine like a hungry dog begging for liver and intestines to swallow, what's there to talk about? I realise responding's a mistake as soon as I let the thought out, capering madly through the empty chambers of my skull, but by then, it's too late. I've admitted that Lecter is calling me, even through the wards and chains and bindings of his case. And silly me, I've walked right past the bus stop. So I keep on walking.
I'm lonely.
I stumble on a loose paving stone and nearly go over on one heel, so shocked that my surroundings barely register. You have got to be kidding me. Lecter is lonely? Why is that my problem?
The host is my eyes. The host is my ears. Without the host, I am trapped forever in the red, warm, pulsing darkness.
This is just too creepy for words. For a long time now, I've had an internal argument with myself about whether Lecter is sentient in his own right, or just a passenger that stimulates his host's brain to fulfil his basic need for sustenance. Like one of those hideous isopod parasites Bob told me about. Or like Mary's V parasite, the thing that lends her various powers in return for the curse of a peculiar thirst. In which case, my conversations with Lecter are just me talking to myself under the influence of a brain-controlling parasite, which is pretty bad. But this implies that Lecter is sentient and aware when I'm not around. That when I lock him in the safe and go somewhere, I'm placing an intelligent being in a sensory deprivation cell, deaf and blind. When we do this to people, we call it torture. Lecter isn't a person. Whatever he may be, he's far too dangerous to set free. But he's at least a Class 4 agency, and if he's fully sentient, in the absence of his host...
I know you fear my hunger. It is my nature. I cannot be otherwise. But must you torment me so?
I'm not tormenting you, I reply automatically.
These past days, alone in the warm darkness, you leave me.
The words decay into an incoherent impression of oceanic vastness and a sense of longing.
Parted so long from my greater self, I seek reunion. Denied reunion, I crave experience.
My skin crawls. Just how much of my life has Lecter been experiencing vicariously? Too much, I get it. The question is, can I turn this craving for experience to my advantage? What do you want from me? I ask.
Bear me. Be my eyes and see for me. Be my ears and hear for me. Don't leave me alone in the warm red darkness.
I shake myself out of my conversational reverie. Look round. It's beginning to rain. I hold out my arm. Taxi. For a moment, I'm afraid that my still only intermittent invisibility superpower is going to cut in. But then a black cab swerves towards me, and I give it my address, and the hell with the cost. I'm not going to get caught out in a late summer thunderstorm with a haunted violin whispering to me. If I carry you around, will you stay the hell out of my dreams? I ask.
Yes.
Lecter feels eager. But he shuts up. And that night, for the first time in weeks, instead of locking him in the warded safe in the hall, I place his case beside me on the other side of the bed when I sleep. Date night. Saturday is a bit of a blur, to be honest. I sleep sinfully late, not rising until well after 8. The morning goes on housekeeping chores, neglected during the week. Lecter watches, in his case, while I vacuum and iron and run the washing machine. A strangely passive voyeurism. And what must it be like to be an alien spirit bound into an instrument carved from the agonized bones of dying men and women, immobile and helplessly dependent on a human host, hungry for experience and thirsty for blood? Watching while the human host irons the next week's workwear? Around lunchtime, I go for a brisk walk around the park in lieu of the gym. I'd have to leave Lecter in a locker, and I have a most peculiar feeling that he'd consider it a breach of trust. Then back home in mid-afternoon. Whereupon, it's time to get ready for the concert, and I suddenly realise I don't know what to wear. Last time out, Jim said black tie. But this is the last night of the proms. The real tradition at the last night is fancy dress. The more outrageous, the better. I've got one half-way current evening gown, or the little black dress I wore to the reception on the oil rig. But I'm not really into costuming. In fact, I don't think I've worn any kind of costume since... since last Monday, now that I think about it. Bingo. Jim was going to pick me up around 6, so I grab my phone and text him. It's the last night. Going to wear fancy dress. So while the imp of the perverse has my attention, I pick up the uniform kit bag from where I left it in the hall and take it through to the kitchen. Playing dress up really isn't like me, but nothing that's happened since that horrible morning when I woke up to the phone ringing and the empty bed and answered a call to Trafalgar Square has really been me. At least, not the me I've been trying to become for the past decade. Once upon a time, there was a me who wouldn't have blinked twice at the idea of going on a date in fancy dress. Once upon a time, I had room for frivolity. What happened? I've been so busy running in circles, being the responsible adult in a madhouse as the world slowly comes apart at the seams, that I've pretty much forgotten what it's like to have fun. Now that I've got my very own superhero kindergarten to run, I'm even busier being a responsible adult than when I was simply wearing Agent Candid's shoes. But there's not much fun in that life. Not very much frivolity. Not very much Mo, as opposed to Dr. O'Brien. I've been shoveling the bits of me that don't fit the sharp-edged requirements of the workday week into a mental closet. An overstuffed closet, now bulging at the edges. Well, damn it. There's still some space for fun in my life. I can, too, go to the last night of the proms on the arm of a superhero. And there's only one way to do it. When the bell rings at 6 on the dot, I am ready and waiting. Come in, I call, unlocking the door to find Jim on the front step. Well, what do you think? Jim's eyes widen. He swallows. Fancy dress, right? He removes his uniform cap and holds it as he inspects me from head to toe. Right. Jim is immaculately turned out in a police chief superintendent's full dress uniform, complete with white gloves and an inordinate quantity of metal ribbons on his chest. I suppose it makes sense. We're going to the proms on tickets liberated from the commissioner's own office, after all. And as for me... Ramona delivered on the alterations we'd discussed on Monday. In addition to the sinister-looking helmet and the Borg-style head-up display and comms headset, the kit bag contained a classic black half-mask that hooks over the ears and a half-length cape, clearly modelled on the rain capes coppers on the beat used to wear back during Jack the Ripper's days. By leaving off the cargo pants, helmet, and anti-stab vest, but keeping the leggings, cape, and mask, I managed to assemble a passable comic book superheroine outfit. With the cape slung across Lecter's case, I only look slightly hunchbacked. And if it all goes horribly wrong, well, I can turn invisible and die of embarrassment in private, right? What do you think? I repeat, still uncertain. I'm more worried about my makeup than the outfit itself. Nothing washes out your cheeks and lips like a velvet half-mask, but I'm worried that I overcompensated on the theatrical side. I think you look great, Jim says, with that desperately fervent tone some men affect when they're trying to think their way through the social minefield of commenting on their date's attire half an hour after it's too late to do anything about it. Then his brain finally catches up with where he wants it to be. He slowly smiles. You know what? They're going to think we're both in fancy dress. I grin at him, trying for impish, and he offers me his arm, which necessitates him putting his hat back on. His BMW is waiting at the side of the road. He opens the door for me, and we roar off very slowly into the London evening traffic. Jim finds a parking slot just off Bayswater Road. It's a big concert, with overflow screens and a huge crowd in the park. The weather has improved since yesterday's overcast and rain, and we stroll, or rather promenade, along Broad Walk, past the Round Pond, mingling with the crowds who are here for the outdoor event. Big repeater screens are set up behind the soundstage, and the orchestra for the Prom in the Park concert are tuning up as we hang a left in the direction of the Albert Memorial and then head across the road to the hall itself, where, despite the hour, there is still a huge queue of prom-goers. Patriotic excess is the rule rather than the exception in this crowd. There are balloons and Union Jack flags galore, and immensely silly costumes. We take our place in the queue behind a man dressed as John Bull, complete with Union Jack waistcoat. Steampunk seems to be the thing this year among the dedicated costumers, and in front of a couple in full evening dress. Behind them, a group of flag-waving younger concert-goers seem to have decided that tweed is the new black. Students, I think, too painfully earnest to be true hipsters. Behind them, I spot a Dalek accompanied by two Cybermen, presumably there to help their legless exterminatory friend up the entrance steps. As the queue moves, people are chatting.
"I hear there are some last-minute changes to the programme,"
John Bull tells us. He has an iPhone in a brass and leather case connected to his fob chain.
"What's happening?" I ask.
"Well, the guest conductor is still Sicario Ramo, but word is that they're replacing Henry Wood's Fantasia in the second half with something special."
He looks perturbed, and well he might. The Fantasia on British Sea Songs is a classic staple for the last night concerts, and any true proms geek is bound to be intrigued by a mysterious substitute. A gap has opened up ahead of us while we've been talking.
"Exterminate," grates a pointed electronic rasp from behind me.
Jim casts the Dalek a stony-eyed copper stare, then clears his throat and, taking my arm, steps forward. The queue is moving again.
"Excited?" I ask him.
Jim pauses, nonplussed.
"I think so."
He doesn't sound very excited.
"Well," I squeeze his hand,
"I am."
And I realise it's true. It's a great big party with a party atmosphere and excellent music and a mystery symphony to come.
After the past week, it's a huge relief. An excuse to forget all about work for a few hours. And then... look, it's a concert hall. Not huge by modern standards, but it was enormous when it first opened in 1871. If you've been to classical concerts or rock gigs, or even theatrical performances or musicals, you know the drill. You queue, and the ticket staff check your tickets, and direct you to another queue, past the cloakrooms, where I deposit neither cloak nor violin case, then upstairs, and through fire doors, and along a dark-walled tunnel, in this case lined with wooden panels, then through another door into the auditorium. In our case, we go up an extra flight of stairs instead, then along a curving corridor, with many doors, until Jim finds the door that matches our ticket numbers, and opens it for me. And we're in a box. It's our own little walled-off segment of the dress circle, off to the left of the stage, and very dim inside, but with an unobstructed view out over the floor of the hall. Now, if you are thinking classical music concert, you are probably thinking of a polite middle-aged audience seated in orderly rows before a stage with an orchestra on it. But this is the proms. Indeed, this is the last night of the proms. While there are seats, and we have some, the proms are famously standing concerts. The floor of the Albert Hall is basically a Victorian mosh pit populated by Daleks, Cybermen, women in steampunk dresses, and men in Union Jack waistcoats and bowler hats. There are balloons. There are flags. There is a steady crackle of party poppers and a nostril-tickling peppery smell of gunpowder. The audience are excited.
the air heavy with anticipation. Jim and I take our seats in the front row of the box, and I unsling my violin case and lean it against the front wall. We don't have it to ourselves. We're sharing the darkened box with a gaggle of 50-something men and women, their faces somehow vaguely familiar. Perhaps I've seen them on TV? As I lean forward to take in the vista, I half expect the conductor to abseil down from the rafters in white tie and tails. I can feel Lecter at the back of my mind, soaking it all in. The sounds, the sights, the buzz of quiet anticipation rising from the audience like steam from a simmering pot. "When is it going to kick off?" Jim asks, just as the lights dim, and the conductor walks onto the stage from the rear. I shush him and sit back, expectantly, and a woman sits beside me and clears her throat. "That's Sakaria Ramo, isn't it, Dr. O'Brien?" I startle and glance at her. "Assistant Commissioner Stanwyck?" Yes, it is. Even if I didn't recognise her from the party on the Shard, her uniform would be a big clue. She half smiles. "I'm glad to see Derek's tickets are getting put to use by someone who can appreciate them," she assures me, touching my wrist briefly to diffuse any implied criticism. "I hope you're enjoying yourself. I'm sure you can tell us all about the programme afterward." Beside me, Jim sits rigidly upright, his face expressionless. As my eyes adjust to the darkness, I realise we're sitting in a pack of police top brass. Jim is the knave, and I'm the joker. I wonder what that means. But I don't have long to wonder, because the concert gets underway almost immediately. It opens with a special piece by a contemporary British composer, commissioned by the BBC, then Arnold's Peterloo Overture, with new lyrics, then a couple of songs by middling familiar composers, and next a first, Richard Strauss's Taifer, in a recital by the guest soprano. Look, it's a concert, and I am here to enjoy myself. If you're that interested, you can look up the running order on the web or stream the broadcast via BBC iPlayer. Most of you won't be, though, so I'm not going to bore you with it. Let's just see. Big symphony orchestra, famous guest conductor, violin soloist, soprano, tenor, and baritone, and a medley of old favourites and innovative new compositions performed to an appreciative standing audience of thousands, with an atmosphere more like a big stadium rock gig than a normal classical event. I open my ears and eyes wide, soaking it all in. A little part of my brain is watching the soloist's technique, observing the conductor's cueing and execution. That bit of your brain that you simply can't switch off when you're observing a virtuoso performance in a field you know something about. And another part of me is distantly aware that Lecter is listening eagerly, vicariously marinating in my emotional responses. But I don't have enough concentration to spare on irritation. And anyway, isn't that why I agreed to bring him? All too soon, the crescendo of applause and the rising lights signal the intermission. Jim claps enthusiastically. Around us, our temporary companions are only slightly more restrained. "That was really rather good," Laura Stanwyck confides in me, to her partner. "Don't you think so, Alan?" Alan, whoever he is, 60-ish, distinguished, salt and pepper hair, agrees. "Quite special." The hall public address system announces a 20-minute break, drowning out the rest of his response. "Would you like anything from the bar?" Jim asks, framing his question to take in both myself and his proximate superior. "A glass of wine?" Stanwyck accepts his offer. "A G&T would be marvellous." "And mine's a Sauve Blanc," I tell him with a smile. "Be right back." He taps two fingers to his forehead briefly, as if saluting, then slips out of his seat. A moment later, Stanwyck lays a hand on my wrist. I tense involuntarily, a premonition sending chills up my spine. "Director, would you walk with me?" She nods towards the front of the box.
Bring your instrument, please.
I pick up Lecter as she stands, then follow her towards the door. I know a setup when I see one. The only question is, how deep does this go? I should have known Jim didn't get those tickets by accident. As I follow Stanwyck out, I reach for my phone. It's in the utility pouch on my belt. One glance tells me there are plenty of notifications. Just a moment, I say, glancing at the screen. Stanwyck doesn't bother with her own phone. There's no signal in here, she tells me. These booths were redecorated recently with shielded wallpaper to cut down on interruptions. I see. I put the phone away and swallow, trying to work up some saliva. My heart pounds unevenly as I tighten my grip on the violin case's quick release button. The notifications all came from the offcut suite running on the device. There's a strong thom field here. Too strong. Where are we going?
There's someone I'd like you to meet, backstage.
She glances over her shoulder.
We don't have much time if we want to be ready for the second half.
I look round, following her gaze. Her companion, Alan, is following us. Now there's enough light, I can see that he's another deputy commissioner. What exactly is going on? I ask, as my feet carry me after her.
Later,
she says tensely. There are other concertgoers in the corridor. Stanwyck leads me to the staircase, then heads down them briskly. We go with the flow for the time being, but once we reach the ground floor, there's another staircase going down, and very little traffic. The corridors here have scuff guards on the walls and uncarpeted floors, and I find myself curiously unsurprised when, as we turn into one, another two cops fall into step behind us. These two, wearing street patrol gear, stabbies, and high-vis jackets over black combats, pistols discreetly holstered on their hips.
Well, that tears it.
The skin-crawling sensation that I've been aware of for the past week, that there's a target pinned between my shoulders, is back in full strength. I can feel Lecter coming to full alertness, coiling and writhing slowly in the smoky velvet-lined void in his case. The adversary surely has me in his sights. But the police? We come to an office. Just past it, there's a staircase leading up to the doors in back of the stage. It's cluttered with desks and papered with posters announcing past performances. Stanwyck makes a beeline for the director's desk and sits down behind it. There's a folio in the middle of the desk, and she opens it and begins to sort through papers.
Go ahead, Alan, she says. I'll take it from here.
If you're sure.
Yeah.
She looks straight at me.
Dr. O'Brien, sit down.
There is no please. I sit opposite her, acutely aware of the two armed officers flanking the only exit. I lick my lips.
What's going on? I ask.
I think you know what's going on. Stanwyck looks at me sharply.
But we don't have time to tango right now. I'm going to have to ask you to read this, please.
Read. She slides a letter from the folio across the desk towards me. I take it with nerveless fingers. It's on Home Office letterhead. And in one brief paragraph, it sets out my worst nightmare. It identifies Freudstein. It tells me what to do. And it puts me in a terrible quandary. For the past few months, the biggest source of stress in my working life has been our lack of progress in identifying our mad science villain. The obvious answer, so obvious it has been our main avenue of investigation, is that the pseudonym Professor Freudstein is the front for an organisation. Why is it obviously an organisation? Because there might be an evil genius somewhere in the picture, or even a mad scientist. But in this century, you don't do science without teamwork. Neither do you break into the Bank of England on your own or the Sellafield product and residues store
much less the British Library. Each of those incidents has to have involved one or more insiders, or someone with privileged information and the ability to suborn a high-level security system. So, Freudstein is a group of people able to stage remarkable coordinated operations with virtual impunity. A group with access to fissile nuclear materials. A team who are able to stay inside my unit's observation decision loop, able to plan the most sophisticated schemes. These are not the activities of a rogue genius or a loose cannon. These are the coldly calculated actions of a sophisticated organisation that has huge resources and understands criminality too well for it to actually be a criminal. And now, I know what that organisation is.
You are absolutely out of your fucking mind, I tell the assistant commissioner in charge of the Specialist Operations Directorate of the London Metropolitan Police. And if you think I am going to cooperate with this, you have another think coming. I push the letter back across the table at her, then cross my arms. Not going to happen.
Laura's face goes still, in a peculiarly over-controlled way that suggests she's bottling everything up tight. She pauses for a couple of seconds before she speaks again. This time, in the distant tones of a copper reading a charge sheet to a petty criminal she's just nicked.
Dr. O'Brien, you have just been presented with a written order signed by the Home Secretary under Part 2 of the Civil Contingencies Act 2004, declaring a large-scale civil emergency and ordering you to support special operations as directed by my command. In case it has escaped your attention, you swore an oath before a magistrate not very many months ago. This is all by the book. Her smile is thin and utterly lacking in humour. Are you rejecting a lawful order?
I try to centre myself.
May I suggest that running a false flag supervillain operation is one thing, but ordering the deployment of a Class 6 quasi-sentient occult invocation engine is another matter entirely?
You can suggest it, but I'm not listening. She mimes, hear no evil.
This is a crisis, Dr. O'Brien. You don't get to say no. You're part of Operation Freudstein now, and you're going to play the violin sonata from the second act of that manuscript.
You have got to be kidding.
Convince me.
Play for time.
I fidget with the ring on my right hand, desperately aware that if Mary mistakes it for a routine itch or is sleeping or otherwise distracted. Stanwyck gestures at the glass wall, separating us from the ops room.
You've got all the pieces. 5 minutes time out won't hurt.
Tell me what your hypotheses are, and I'll set you straight.
Hypothesis?
I shrug.
You're part of a working group within ACPO, the Association of Chief Police Officers. A clearinghouse and information exchange between territorial forces, operating at the very highest level, with some staff seconded from other forces, that also undertakes operations directly on behalf of the Home Office. Your command has responsibility for a bunch of major security briefs. You run the counter-terrorism command, what used to be Special Branch, among other things. You're therefore the logical person to put in charge of responding to the imminent threat to law and order posed by a... I check with my internal sensor. It grants permission for me to continue, which is in itself worrying. Sudden sharp spike in the prevalence of both ritual magic and informal paranormal powers, commonly interpreted by those on the receiving end as making them superheroes. She nods minutely, so I continue, listening for the caution of a still, small inner voice. You plotted the same graphs that my employers have been sweating over for the past few months. You saw the sudden upswing and worried that before long everyone would be casting fireballs, levitating, building space stations, and generally getting in the way of community policing. So you began looking for a solution to the problem, framed tightly as a superpowered public order issue.
Then my people came along. Have you signed Section 3? She nods. I know who you are, she says, with a surprising level of quiet vehemence. SOE. Another wartime relic. Her cheek twitches. We are out of the unlawful activities business, Dr. O'Brien. We're part of the Home Office, not the Ministry of Defence. Unlike your employers, we attempt to do everything by the book. Sometimes we fail. And then it's time for professional standards and the IPCC to work out what went wrong. But the point is, we don't cut corners. I roll my eyes. Sure. And we deal with threats you can't handle. Existential threats. Your job is to enforce the law. But the law in question applies to human beings here on this Earth. It doesn't work so well after a nuclear war, which is the only sane comparison for what my organization is responsible for heading off. That's where you're wrong. She gives me a brief feral smile and taps the disastrous letter again. It's lawful. It's signed by the Home Secretary herself, and I'm not willing to bet that my laundry warrant card can trump it. Short of getting it countersigned by the Queen, it doesn't go much higher than this. Civil Contingencies Act, Dr. O'Brien. It was drafted to govern exactly that sort of situation. Shit. She is, of course, technically correct. The CCA is the overarching piece of civil defence and disaster preparedness legislation that governs how the United Kingdom would be ruled in the aftermath of a nuclear war or an invasion by undead alien gods. She's got me banged to rights. And she continues remorselessly. You agree that it's my organisation's job to enforce the law, don't you? Where is she going with this? Yes. Well, we consider the outbreak of 3 to 5 Sigma superpowers to be a critical problem. An out-of-context problem for the practice of policing, if you're familiar with the term. Oh, God. We have to take preventative action to stop it from turning into a tidal wave of lawlessness. And we have to do it as soon as possible. Before disasters like the EDL March and Oldham become daily occurrences. Your sock puppet, public relations superhero team, isn't going to provide a constructive role model for our superpowered youth. It's just going to be the butt of their jokes. Don't think it hasn't been tried before any number of times. During various panics over juvenile delinquency. We're facing Armageddon, Dr. O'Brien. We've got to head it off before it happens. A nightmare of lawless rioting lumpen proletariat with superpowers is just around the corner. You may be concerned with the defence of the realm, but I'm concerned with ensuring there's a realm left to defend. Aren't you exaggerating a bit? I ask. That's a mistake. Laura proceeds to deliver the smackdown in the shape of a canned 3-minute lecture on law and disorder in the big city. Our total overall detection rate is just 24%, Dr. O'Brien. Less than a quarter of reported crimes for which we get a confirmed clear-up. In some areas, offences against vehicles, burglary, theft and criminal damage. We're under 15%. In reality, most of those crimes are the work of a hardcore of serial offenders, so we get them eventually. But in the meantime, it creates a chilling climate. It creates the impression that we are institutionally incapable of preventing crime. Law-abiding citizens like yourself go about in a state of fear out of all proportion to the scale of the problem, fanned by the tabloid media. Meanwhile, real criminals feel empowered and invulnerable. If some of them subsequently become invulnerable in reality, we will have a desperately serious problem. Bad enough if they were to be robbing sleepy banks who pay insufficient attention to securing their vaults. She reaches into the folio and produces a police evidence baggie containing a pair of DLT tapes. Think of the climate of fear. We can't afford to let go for a split second, Doctor. We're all that stands between you and anarchy, red in tooth and claw. I know where Laura is coming from now. She's a member of the
You couldn't handle the truth slash thin blue line saving you from drowning in a sea of filth, School of Police opinion. Which is all very well. But better policing and more powers to stop and search isn't going to protect us when the sleeper in the pyramid wakes up.
That's not going to happen, I point out. I don't know if you've been briefed yet, but the superpowered are at risk of K-type dementia. The more power they use, the faster they're going to come down with.
Doesn't matter, Doctor. A malevolent 5 Sigma who succumbs to a neurodegenerative condition after 2 weeks is still a disaster.
Her eyes widen slightly.
Is Jim Gray at risk?
I nod.
Oh dear.
We, the Laundry, have some experience in managing this condition. There are techniques that can reduce an occult practitioner's susceptibility. They may work for superpowers too. After all, they're just informal ritual practitioners with an intuitive slash somatic interface. But, if you want to tackle the superpowered, you need to build hospitals, not super dungeons. Nevertheless, she swallows, looking appalled. She's genuinely rattled, if I'm any judge of character at all.
If I give full credit to what you're telling me, that just makes your willing participation in Operation Freudstein all the more important.
Tell me more. I'm fascinated.
Why the name?
It's a portmanteau. The 20th century was bookended by the nightmares of Freud and Einstein. Freudstein is a high-profile awareness-raising exercise to show everyone just how dangerous a 5-sigma criminal can be. We can point to his activities and say, that's why we need these special contingency powers, before it's too late. For a project simulating a mad scientist whose goal is to provide the impetus and the mechanism for performing surgery on the collective subconscious of a nation, what could be more appropriate?
I nod encouragement. Let me guess. This sonata you want me to play. It's from The King in Yellow, isn't it? The second act? Or the third?
Yes. The assistant commissioner looks past me at something happening in the control room.
You know The Last Night is being broadcast live. Audio on Radio 3 and television on BBC One.
We can push this broadcast a bit further. We can tie into the backbone routers at Telehouse Docklands using the same interconnect GCHQ use for their MTI surveillance. And we can transparently redirect the DNS queries from any computer in the UK to point wherever we want them to. In a nutshell, we're going to piggyback your solo on every YouTube video session in the country. At the same time, we will push a playout update to Sky and Virgin, the satellite and cable monopolists for the UK.
We won't get everyone, but a good 30% of the population should receive saturation coverage. Maybe even half.
She smiles encouragingly.
Just think. You'll have the biggest audience of any live event in Britain since the royal wedding.
I frown. Her smile goes away.
What's the payload?
I ask.
She leans forward. Peel's 9 principles of policing.
The lightning grin comes out again.
We're not stupid, you know. We know about the risks of installing a firmware upgrade in somebody's brain. So the core message is very simple. The police are the public, and the public are the police. I can hardly believe your organisation, been sitting on such an incredibly powerful tool for decades, and nobody's thought of doing this before.
We're facing a crisis of law enforcement. Just getting a third of the population to work with us, including a third of the superpowered, is going to go a huge way towards mitigating the... She keeps on wittering away. But I am half past listening. I make pleasant face contortions and nod occasionally while I try and work out what to do. In the distance, I hear Lecter crying out. Single-stringed moans of hunger and need. There's been no response from my ring. For all I can tell, it's a piece of inert jewellery. I can tell her the instrument is cursed until I go blue in the face. It won't help. The assistant commissioner has a PhD in criminology and runs on Home Office dictated rails. She doesn't hold with antiquated beliefs in curses or intrinsically evil instruments, and I doubt she can sight-read sheet music well enough to know what the King in Yellow is all about. Hand her a tool that can install a rootkit in 20 million brains, and she doesn't see any risk that isn't outweighed by the promise of installing a police state machine in those heads. She's running out of exhortations and starting to look at me askance, as if wondering why I'm not agreeing with her more enthusiastically. I'm out of time. It's feasible in principle, I admit reluctantly. The trouble is, the violin is very hard to control. I don't think so. She stands up. I've read your personnel file. You're the most powerful wielder that instrument has had in decades. You've outlasted all but one of your predecessors, haven't you? You can sight read. I'm assured it's not a very complicated piece. For its impact, it depends as much on the instrument as on the score. But I can't, or don't want to, she demands sharply. Dr. O'Brien, I'm not asking you to play that sonata, I'm ordering you to. But, Keith, Martin, get her on stage. She addresses the armed cops on the door. Interval's nearly over, and she's on next. To me. You will do as I say, she says, holding up the letter, the words on the page crawling before my eyes as with blue fire. By the power vested in me, I command and compel you. And as the gash on the page gets its fingers into my head, I feel myself standing involuntarily, grip tightening on my violin case. I turn towards the door, unable to help myself. Jim will hold the score for you, she tells me. Now, get up there and do your job, officer. I can't stop myself. And as my feet carry me towards the steps leading up to the back of the stage in the Albert Hall, unready and unwilling to give the performance of my life, I work out why. The gash working against me is my own oath of office. I was lawfully assigned to the security service and thence to the Home Office. So Deputy Commissioner Stanwyck is lawfully able to order me to do this, with authority right from the top of my secondment. It'd take the SA himself suspending me from active duty to break me out of this trap. And in the meantime, I'm climbing the stairs with Lecter crooning tuneless alien phrases in the back of my mind. And then, the spotlight leads my unwilling feet towards the violin soloist's podium. And I'm out of time.